You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 23rd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author Don Peck from the Atlantic Monthly magazine and author of Pinched, How the Great Recession has narrowed our futures and what we can do about it. Also in the program today, why is it that Republicans keep harping on the nearly half of the people in this country who do not pay federal income taxes? More Republican attacks on the poor and the middle class. An update on the administration pressure of New York Attorney General. Get off the backs of those poor Wall Street guys. 162 people now been arrested in the ongoing tar sands protests. And in addition, people have been protesting all around the country. You wouldn't know about it. Arguing you shouldn't cut our Social Security and Medicare for the benefit of the elite rich in this country, in the better half of the show, I will be discussing my appearance on Dylan Radigan's program yesterday. And Anonymous, still at it. A week later, another protest yesterday in San Francisco. This time, more than three dozen protesters were arrested during what appears to have been a fairly chaotic run downtown San Francisco. More than 100 protesters, and I didn't see video this time of it. So based upon the way this was reported last time, I imagine there was significantly more than 100 protesters. Shut down more of BART stations and marched down the streets over the course of 3 hours in downtown San Francisco. Anonymous, still, you know, causing problems for those BART officials who decided to quash the first protest against the shooting of an unarmed man by BART policemen. BART being the San Francisco, the Bay Area Transit Authority. And I don't know. I guess these protests will continue. You can follow it on OpBART is the Twitter feed. More on that as the show progresses. Again, folks, this show exists only because of member support. So we need your memberships at Majority FM. Other ways to support the show, of course, justcoffee.coop. Buy your junk from Amazon through our Amazon link. A little kickback to the show. Never hurts. And, of course, you can donate your account. If you want that Marc Maron interview and you're not a member, you can get it by donating your Facebook account. Or what was the other thing we wanted to do? Give us some likes. Right? On Facebook? What was the other thing?
To leave reviews on iTunes for our podcast.
to what? What do we? Well, you want to?
Why
aren't you people giving us a review on iTunes? That takes 3 minutes. Just give us like 5 stars. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Don Peck. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Features editor for The Atlantic Magazine and author of Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Don Peck, welcome to the program, Don.
Thanks, Sam.
So, Don, I've read your piece that's coming out in this month's Atlantic, Can the Middle Class Be Saved? And there's a wonderful sort of exchange and forum going on the Atlantic site, back and forth. And the piece is tremendous, and we only have 15 minutes here, so I don't want to go through the whole thing, but you make the case that the middle class is being is under incredible pressure and is, over the past 20 or 30 years, has been diminishing rapidly, particularly in the last 10. Let me start with this. What is the importance of the middle class to our society?
Oh, it's tremendously important to American society. I mean, when you think about the U.S., we're not really bound by common heritage or a very old culture. I think what binds us together instead is a sense of optimism, a future orientation, a sense of progress and opportunity, and a broad middle class that can progress is really essential to that. And unfortunately, what we're seeing now is the steady hollowing of that middle class. And with it, I think a reduction in opportunity, fewer stepping stones for people to move from the lower class or the working class upwards. If that continues, I think it would have really bad consequences for America.
I mean, is there something? There have been periods in our in extended periods, and perhaps maybe. I don't know. I don't really know. Maybe the majority of time that America has existed, certainly not in the past 100 years, but or the past 70 years, I should say. But there hasn't necessarily been a robust middle class. How much of our society's just actual survival, in terms of stability, is tied to that? I mean, I wonder, as we see this trend you outline different things that we can do to change this trend, but if we don't see a reversal of this trend, what then happens? I mean, I'm particularly interested in one of the last posts that you had about the middle class being invisible to the elite.
That's right. Well, you know, what's interesting in this recession, and as I note in Pinched, is it's really affected different classes and different places very differently. And while we have seen a lot of job loss concentrated in the non-professional middle class, and while that particular class has been under pressure for years, inequality has actually risen during this recession, which is unusual. Highly educated, highly skilled people clustered in places like Manhattan and Silicon Valley and Washington, D.C. have been recovering. Wage growth in those populations has been extremely strong. And as you say, you know, because there's been both a class separation and a geographic separation in the U.S., with elites clustering together more and more in a handful of power cities and creative enclaves, you know, I think there's been kind of an emotional distance between the most influential Americans, including Americans' political class, and the rest of the U.S. And I think that has profoundly shaped the reaction to the jobs crisis. You know, once the stock market started going back up again in 2009, that's really when the government lost its focus on stimulus and on jobs creation. So I think. That it's entirely possible, actually, that the economy as a whole could recover, But that recovery, you know, could be concentrated very much among a small plutocracy, you know, the top 1%, 10%, 20% of society. Is that stable in the long run? You know, certainly in deeper into U.S. history, in the 1890s, for instance, it didn't look stable. And that's one reason why our government ultimately engaged in some major reforms that helped the middle class. Will it be this time around? I don't know.
And you mentioned the sort of the emotional distance that the elite have from the middle class at this time. Is there also something that has changed in our economy where the elite don't necessarily have a different structural distance from the middle class in terms of its success is no longer or the elite's success, I should say, is no longer bound by the middle class's success?
Yes, that's absolutely true. You know, I spent some time last summer at the Aspen Ideas Festival, which is a colloquy of the rich and powerful. And, you know, what I heard again and again from executives, CEOs, entrepreneurs was, you know, we get our labor anywhere in the world now, and increasingly our sales are derived worldwide, and particularly in the growing markets in Asia. And you know, so they're not really as dependent on the health of the American workforce, the health of the American economy as they used to be. And what's more, I think the elite today, you know, the people at Aspen, you know, they're equally comfortable in London, Shanghai, Paris as they are, you know, anywhere in the U.S. They view themselves as a global elite. And that too, I think, has created kind of a distance from the troubles and travails of everyday Americans. So I think we need to be careful. You know, we should celebrate people who make great accomplishments, but I do think we need to be increasingly careful about conflating, you know, the interests of American executives and even American companies and the interests of American workers.
I mean, is that bias sort of baked into the, or I should say, is there a bias that's baked into the cake in the way that we officially measure the success of our economy? I mean, when we talk about, you know, a return to growth in terms of GDP, and when we talk about a measure of the economy relative to the stock market rebounding, I mean, is there not like a bias that's baked into that that calculation, which would allow for the definition of a good economy to be something that that could benefit theoretically just 10 to 15% of the country and not the other 80% of the people?
Absolutely. You know, one thing I note in Pinched is over the last decade or so, you know, by some measures, the economy before the recession was doing pretty well. However, when you actually look at income growth, what you find is that from 2002 to 2007, out of every $3 of U.S. income growth, two of those dollars were captured by the top 1% of society. The other dollar was split among the bottom 99%.
That is stunning. That is stunning. So for every three, I have to just repeat this because this is just that is stunning. For every $3 of income growth, two of those dollars went to the top 1%.
That's right. And, you know, in fact, a group of Citibank analysts in 2006 looked at the economy and they said, we're in a new state, and they coined it the plutonomy. And their point was that so much money and so much wealth was held by the elite, and so much money was flowing through their hands. So much of national spending was dominated by the elite that was really the only group you needed to look at in thinking about stock returns. The rest of America for investment decisions just didn't matter. So we've been evolving, you know, before the recession, but it's been accelerated by the recession. We've been evolving towards an economy that the top line is capable of looking healthy, but wealth is really concentrated. Purchasing power is really concentrated. And I think that's, you know, culturally and socially a direction that perhaps we don't want to go much further towards.
Right. Well, I mean, because in addition to it being a plutonomy, it's also a plutocracy, and that's certain, sort of inevitable, particularly in the way that our system has been developing, be it, you know, court cases like Citizen United or simply the way that we elect our officials, is that the pernicious effects of that is of that concentration of money is that it's also a concentration of political power.
Absolutely. There is unavoidably there is a relationship between wealth and power, and wealth can become self-reinforcing when you know, the riches become so extreme that the elite can kind of, you know, buy political decisions, that they are always in front of members of Congress. And I think we see that with the financial industry to a large degree today, you know, which to a surprising extent, given the size and nature of the crash, has avoided new regulation and remains the beneficiary of an implicit guarantee against catastrophic failure. So one of the, you know, one of the great concerns that I have for our country is that, you know, this relationship will become self-sustaining, you know, at the same time that most Americans not only aren't seeing a lot of new wealth, but are actually downwardly mobile.
Has there ever been a concerted attempt to change the way that we calculate the GDP in this country? I mean, in a way that would reflect a different sort of value set?
You know, I've heard there have been experimental efforts in the past, but to my knowledge, none of them has really gained traction. You know, we are able at least to look at things like median income growth, you know, how the person in the very middle of U.S. society is doing. And I think that, you know, the media is beginning to report more on, you know, what's happening at the median, what's happening to different education levels. And I hope that will continue because, I mean, when you look, for instance, at men without a college degree, you know, what you see is not progress. You see declining wages for 30 years. You see men dropping out of the labor force, men with high school but not a college degree, you know, over 30 years. In 1967, 97% of prime-age working men with a high school diploma but not a college degree were working. Today, it's only 76%. And when you start focusing on those kinds of statistics, you see real problems for the center of American society. You see related problems in family, because when men aren't working, women don't marry them. And you know, it helps you to see a society which I think is in many ways much less healthy at its middle, you know, in its center, than many Americans presume.
You outlined, and I know you have to go in just a moment, but you outlined three basic areas where we need to improve in terms of innovation and education. And then finally, basically, the plutocracy needs to kick more into the system. What's the most important? I mean, is there a trigger that can get that ball rolling?
Well, I mean, I think given unemployment rates today, you know, I think the most important thing in the short run is more government spending, more direct job creation, and getting more cash into people's pockets to get the economy moving again today. But you know, looking further into the future, yeah, I mean, I think we've placed so much emphasis in the U.S. on getting a bachelor's degree, which is a great thing to do, and everyone should be encouraged to do it. But we've kind of ignored other pathways into the middle class. You know, today only 30% of Americans, even among young adults, has a four-year college degree. That's been growing very, very slowly over time. So a college degree is not the entirety of the answer to how to fix the problems of the middle class. I think we should look much more at robust vocational programs, apprenticeship programs. You know, Germany, for instance, has used these very effectively to allow its high school students, you know, to see pathways into real careers, to building skills both inside and outside the classroom, and to producing a more stable and robust middle class. I think we need to be doing that as a society as well.
All right. Well, Don Peck, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your taking the time. I got to say, from my perspective, we got to start by taking away some of those elites' money, frankly, through the tax system, so that we can diminish that power.
I agree with you. I think that's actually an important part of the situation of the solution as well.
All right, Don Peck from the Atlantic Magazine, and of course, author of Pinched: How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, let's talk about those slackers. Those slackers are getting away without paying federal income tax. That's the problem with this country, folks. We have 47% of Americans not paying any federal income tax, probably hanging out in Cannes. The Côte d'Azur, probably. It's August, right? They're probably taking 4 weeks in the Côte d'Azur. Maybe they're sitting around on the tarmacs with their private jets, just waiting for the caterer to show up. Let's get on these people. When we come back, we're going to hand it to them. We'll be right back. All right. We are back. Ladies and gentlemen, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. The completely member-supported Majority Report. No outside. Again, I was on. I was on Dylan Radigan's program yesterday, and guest hosted by Matt Miller. I keep forgetting to ask him, like, you know, dude, what? I thought you were gonna come on my show. You took my email address. And you just put me on an email list. But I didn't, I forgot, frankly. My favorite moment is always when Tim Carney, who is also a regular on the Monday Mega Panel, reminds everybody that Matt Miller is with the Center for American Progress. I think Carney doesn't like the Center for American Progress. And he always sort of, like, makes sure that he prefaces and introduces Matt Miller in that way. He's not in a position to introduce him. I don't know how he worked it in. But we will attach the entire segment to the member show. But in probably, I don't know, maybe we'll get to it in the lesser half. But in the better half, we will certainly go over it. Because there was an exchange I had with Representative Larson, Democrat from Congress. He seems to be a regular on the show because I had asked him once before. Sometimes I'm just sort of shocked at the political incompetence of these people. Here's a guy who I think for the most part, I imagine that I agree with him on a policy level. Although last time he was on, he was talking about the benefits of cutting spending and cutting our deficit while simultaneously saying that we need job growth, and there's only one way we're going to get job growth now. Don Peck mentioned it. I mean, there's only one way. You need direct government intervention, although there is another plan, and I will talk about that in just a moment, that there's another plan that we could actually do right now, regardless of Congress. So save your emails if you're upset that I in any way criticize President Obama. Because it's not simply a function that the Republicans are crazy. I know the Republicans are crazy. There's stuff that we can do right now without congressional approval. And by we, I mean President Obama. Can do right now that would have a positive impact on our economy. Would not create jobs directly, but would certainly create aggregate demand. We will get to that in a moment. But this I need to deal with because this seems to be the talking point due jour du campagne, I don't know how to say campaign in French, where you have every single one of the Republican presidential nominees complaining that the problem is not that the top 1%, which controls, what is it, 0.01% controls 40% of our nation's wealth. But the problem is that people in the bottom half of the income distribution, 50% nearly, 47, it's technically 46% of Americans over the age, I guess, of 21 or 18 when you would begin to file taxes, pay no federal income taxes. Now, of course, understand that they say this as if these Americans pay no taxes. But we do know that they pay payroll taxes in the form of Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes, FICA taxes. We also know that they pay things like federal gas taxes. They pay sales taxes. They pay all sorts of other types of taxes. But they don't pay any federal income taxes. And here's the reason. They don't make enough money. Dave Weigel had an interesting point where he wrote about this, and he was saying that, and I don't think, frankly, Tea Partiers are aware of this. But he says, when the Tea Party started rallying in 2009, it wasn't protesting higher taxes because federal income taxes were lower with more loopholes. Well, in fact, I think they were protesting that. They just didn't realize that salient fact that their taxes were, in fact, not higher, and they were actually paying a lower tax rate by any measure, at least from in terms of federal taxes, income taxes, Social Security taxes, et cetera, than they ever have in their entire lives, in their entire sad, sorry lives. He claims that it was protesting the perception, and I think this is poorly written. I don't know how you protest a perception. It was protesting because they perceived that so-called productive Americans were shelling out for an ever-expanding class of moochers. And I think if you dig down into that, A, you find out that based upon statistically where we know Tea Partiers are statistically the most partisan Republicans. We know that they're also the most religious and theocratic Republicans. Statistically speaking, although I don't have this data in front of me, I think it is an extremely safe assumption that they come from those red states, which actually are the biggest moocher states in terms of what they give into the federal government and what they get back from the federal government, in terms of what benefits they receive from the federal government. Now, they're not aware that they receive these benefits. They don't even realize that their Medicare or their Social Security is actually a government benefit. But leave that aside. Ultimately, what we're talking about, and because, again, that study that we talked about the other day, reported in the New York Times, what they're really talking about when they say moochers is they're saying brown people, different shades of non-white people in their eyes. But let's leave that aside for a moment. A plurality, in other words, not the majority, but the biggest group of people who pay no income tax are you ready for it? The elderly. Oh. Why? Because their retirement insurance, much of it not taxable. The other reason, and this is going to come as a shocker, are you ready for this? It's because, of course, they don't work. Oh, right. Old people tend to retire. Now, this, of course, if we lived in a a world that our elite and our establishment would prefer, of course, we would not have such a thing as retirement for anybody under in the bottom four income quintiles. In other words, for 80% of the country, we should really outlaw retirement. But we're not quite there yet. We'll get there if these people have their way. And the rest of the people, at least the vast majority of the people who don't pay taxes, they're incredibly poor. Ezra Klein reported on this, I guess, at the beginning of this month. If you don't make any money, but you take a standard deduction and have few dependents, you're not going to pay any income tax. The example, a couple with two children earning less than $26,000 a year. They get $11,000 worth of standard deduction and four exemptions for $3,700, which takes their tax liability to zero. Now, of course, to make that $26,000, they've paid at least 6% off their payroll taxes, 6.5% off their payroll taxes. They're paying gas tax to get to work. And then they're probably paying local taxes in some shape or form, and sales tax to their states. The basic structure of the income tax simply exempts subsistence levels of income from tax. If you're making just enough or less that you need to survive, then you do not pay an income tax. How horrid. How horrid. So when you hear a Republican say that we need to expand the tax base, what they're saying is we need to tax poor people. And I got news for you. There's no money there. And then once you tax these poor people who are making either no money because they're retired or just enough money to survive week in, week out under a lot of duress, what happens to them? Well, of course, they join the other millions of Americans, 46 million Americans, who are on food stamps. It's roughly 15% of the population. That's an increase of 74%. Since when? Since when? Take a guess. Since what date we've had to increase the number of people on food stamps by 74%?
2007.
Did you read that somewhere?
No, that's right. That's the year right before the stock market.
You're right. You're right. That's just incredible. There's a story from Reuters about a woman who supervises cashiers at a Walmart. So she's not even a cashier. She's mid-management. She has a 12-year-old son. She earns $9.70 an hour. They only give her 26 hours a week, so they don't have to pay any benefits. And she, of course, doesn't make enough to make ends meet. She's on food stamps. She says that after 9 months at Walmart and her probation ended, she maintained her job there. She got the food stamps. She said plenty of her coworkers are also on food stamps. And Bill Simon, head of Walmart's U.S. operations, told a conference call last Tuesday that the company had seen an increase in the number of shoppers relying on food stamps. So you have Walmart selling their products to people on food stamps with people who are on food stamps. So we're basically subsidizing the wages and the sales of Walmart to provide food to these people. Over the past 20 years, the characteristics of the program's recipients had changed. In 1989, there was a higher percentage of people in this program were on some type of government assistance. rather than working. As of 2009, there's a higher percentage who have earned income versus benefits. In other words, this is simply a way of subsidizing the wages that these people are earning. We now have edified a class of people in this country who are working but still can't afford to feed their families. And, oh, what was that other place? In addition to raising the taxes on people who are making subsistence living in this country, what was the other place that the Republicans wanted to cut? Oh, yeah, food stamps. Meanwhile, in Michigan, the legislator is preparing to essentially F over another group of poor people. There's this program called the Michigan Family Independence Program. It basically provides benefits and assistance to the poorest families in Michigan. It has a 4-year lifetime limit on cash welfare benefits. Now, I should tell you that today is the 15-year anniversary, I think it's today, of Bill Clinton's welfare overhaul, which has turned into a disaster. It's just created more and more poor people. It's a great program. You got to get on to work if you have a booming economy and you're growing jobs at an astonishing rate, which just so happened to happen during the Clinton administration. But guess what happens when there are no jobs? You're just creating a whole new group of poor people who basically are struggling to feed their families. So you've got this program in Michigan. It has a 4-year lifetime limit on cash welfare benefits. Now, you understand that when people go in and out of poverty, or I should say, when we talk about the poor in this country, generally, people are not poor throughout their entire lives, year in, year out. Generally, what happens is they are poor, as defined by, what is it, $24,000 for a family of four, or $40,000, I'm sorry, for a family of four. And they dip in and out of poverty. They get a job that pays some money, they're above the poverty line. They get a job, they lose that job, they're below. They get another job that pays less, they're below that poverty line. So there's a 4-year lifetime limit on cash welfare benefits. Months in which the parents are meeting the program's requirement to work for at least 30 hours a week are not counted against this 4-year limit. In other words, if you're earning money during that period of time, it's not counted during that limit, even if the money that you're earning is not sufficient to take you out of the out of poverty. Families living in counties with extremely high unemployment rates by Michigan standards, which must be like somewhere around like 15 or 20%, at least in Michigan standards, are exempted from the limit. The Michigan legislator is trying to change some of these rules to count months in which a family is meeting their work obligations against their 4-year time limit. And the worst part of this, it is retroactive, meaning that any month prior to this change that a family was on this family independence program and meeting their work obligations will count against their 4 years. Even if they were previously told by the state that they were exempted, Department of Human Services estimates that 12,600 families with 25,000 children will immediately lose assistance for the remaining time of their life in the very first month the new time limit goes into effect. This is the same state that has that now undemocratic provision where the governor can take over a municipality for no reason, just to basically quash union contracts. I want to get into this. We got a lot of sound. You will hand me that document at the break. I'm going to push this into the better half. The New York Times has come out against the Obama administration's pressuring Eric Schneiderman to stop his investigation. I have an alternate theory as to what this is about. Because there are other state AGs who are not going along with this deal that is being negotiated. So why are they pressuring state attorney general Eric Schneiderman? My guess is it may have something, though it's not being reported this way, with the idea that the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankenfein, is luring up. Either way, it's stunning bullshit. The bullshit, really, I'm getting just like people arguing with me that it's not Obama, it's the Obama administration. Can you imagine if we measured George Bush's presidency by only the things that he was directly involved with? Or Reagan's presidency? That dude had checked out a year into his second term. It's obscene. It's not about bashing Obama. It's about holding our elected leaders to account, particularly those that we voted for. All right, I will see you on the flip side. You can call us at 646-257-3920. Oh, if you are one of those people, foolish, you decide, like, I don't want to pay 33 cents a day. I don't need the better half of this program. I got news for you. It's right here.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Poopy, poopy, poop.
All right, folks, we'll be back in just a minute. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. We'll be right back.